This story really stood out to me. Did you know that there's a critical shortage of women in cybersecurity, especially in leadership roles? In fact, according to national reports, women represent less than a quarter of the overall workforce in cybersecurity, and there's only one female chief information security officer in the top 10 U.S. companies. So why is that the case? Especially when we know in the U.S. there are more than 700,000 open roles in cybersecurity. To give us a little insight and talk more about this, we're chatting with Lisa O'Connor. And Lisa is the global leader of security research and development at Accenture, which is leading two labs even here in the U.S. And through her work, she protects the global 2,000 companies, critical infrastructures, and advances the industry with her focus on cyber innovation. Lisa, welcome to the show. Good morning.
Melissa, thank you for having me.
First and foremost, Lisa, why do you think women are not as attracted to cybersecurity as a job, or is that a misconception?
It could be a misconception because we see women joining, and in our first piece of research, we studied why women left sort of at the midpoint of their career. And in this research, we looked at the second part of that journey to study how women rise and What are women doing on that journey? What are men doing on that journey? What's different? Why do we have different results in men being in those top positions? That's what we studied, and we get some really interesting insights on how women see themselves in these roles and what they do to prepare and what tactics they use and what men do to rise in these roles.
In your professional opinion, Lisa, why is there such a great need for cybersecurity roles in America?
Oh, my goodness. There's so much. If we just look at the headlines of, you know, ransomware, of threats to critical infrastructure, of the things that we need to defend, and we really think about that as defending a way of life, right? We need cybersecurity in our schools. We need them in our businesses. We need them in our government and state and local. We need cybersecurity everywhere because the safety, the security, the privacy, the trust we need in these systems to operate well is so important to how we're living now. And I think, you know, through the pandemic, we've seen how much we are using information technology, IT, the cloud, these services online. We're incredibly dependent on it. And that's not a bad thing, but we need it to work very well and be safe.
So, Lisa, why do you think, or how, I should say, how do women and men differently approach roles in cybersecurity?
Yeah, so I think from our study and from working with all of these CISOs and getting their insights, women tend to be quieter about their candidacy. They might not ask for all the opportunities or the ability to really be an understudy to the role and get the exposure that they need. We tend to be quieter in how we're approaching these roles. And one of the things that's very apparent, and we've probably seen this in other studies, certainly, is we wait to check all the boxes. We're waiting to make sure we've got everything that's asked for that role 100% before we put our hat in the ring. That's not what men do. So very important to come in with that confidence and know that there's going to be learning, there's going to be other things that you do in that role. But asking and really making sure that your candidacy is clear, you have that leadership support to be pulling you through for those opportunities. And our study showed that men were very successful within the companies that they were in. Women actually were incredibly successful outside of their company when they put their hat in the ring and really applied for something outside. They were hired much faster, which also kind of supports the idea that they were very qualified at that time.
So I have this is probably a little too broad, but I'm going to throw it at you anyways, Lisa, if you don't mind. And we're talking this morning to Lisa O'Connor, a global leader of security research and development at Accenture, which is leading two labs, including one in Washington, D.C. And they look at things like protecting companies, critical infrastructures, and advancing the industry with a focus on cyber innovation. What do you think about schools? And specifically, I'll even talk about high schools or colleges. So I went to a very small school in Burlington, Vermont. It's a business school. And when I went there, they are known for video game technology and cybersecurity, if you can believe it or not. Very random, but it's what they're known for. And when I went there, my roommate, one of my roommates actually went to school for cybersecurity. She's brilliant. I mean, absolutely brilliant. And I remember that in almost all of her classes, she was the only female in that class. Now, again, I know I went to a school of 2,000 kids, so, you know, you're not talking about a major university, but I found that pretty shocking that not only was she the only female in that class, but that throughout her years that she was taking these classes, she was very often, not by professors per se, but by her classmates, you know, like little fun being poked, you know, like, oh, like, you know, what's the best you could really do sort of thing. And you think to yourself, OK, these are 20, 21 year old kids. What, like, why are we even acting like we're in first grade? But I do think that there's still this sense of, you know, not only women in the workplace, but in cybersecurity. Oh, that's a little outside of what women should be doing. And I even got that sense. And again, I've only been out of college for 10 years. So I guess my question to you, Lisa, is what do you think we are lacking on the educational like level when it comes to cybersecurity and really making women feel like they belong in cybersecurity before they even enter the workforce and have confidence to stick up for themselves? Do we do enough on the educational system? Like, do we do enough to really secure them and want them to enter this work?
Yeah, Melissa, those are great questions and insights. And the short answer is no, we don't do enough. Because we're making cybersecurity this thing that we're all supposed to be in the basement with hoodies and hacking things and in a very traditionally male culture. So the visual and see yourself in cyber, that's our theme for this month. Because we want to open those doors and have everybody be able to see themselves in cyber and expand what that perception is, and we've got to do it with kids. We absolutely have to reach kids in elementary school, junior high school, and demystify this and show them women that are in these careers that are doing amazing things. And we have Jen Easterly, who's the head of CISA, who's fantastic. We have some amazing role models that are out there, and they are incredibly competent, incredibly strong, and they're comfortable in their own skin, right? So being themselves. When I went to college, there were all of six other women who were electrical engineers. So I get the being on the underrepresented side there. Mm. I think at that time it was a class of 120. But
wow,
it is important that we're bringing it, we're demystifying it younger to kids, and we're making it fun. We're telling the stories of what cybersecurity really is, not in the basement with hoodies, although you could do that. But it is a whole bunch of other functions. Threat intelligence, we need people from every different background for threat intelligence to be able to understand the adversary. And that's not from the coding or computing. That's understanding how they think, how they behave, what they want, what their desires and hopes are. That's a whole different set of skills, right? And, mm-hmm. and those are so relevant for cybersecurity.
So we're talking about cybersecurity and getting more women into that line of work. And I was curious, we're talking this morning to Lisa O'Connor, who is the global leader of security research and development at Accenture, which is leading two labs in Washington, D.C., as well as in Israel. And I wanted to get your perspective, Lisa. What are some barriers in the way for women considering cyber jobs, especially at higher levels?
Yeah, so I think some of the barriers are in how we're talking about these roles, how we're advertising them, how transparent we are in them. And this is really important, as companies should be asking for a diverse slate. And I'm going to tell you why. Because in my role in cybersecurity R&D, I need diversity. And I need diversity because I need innovation. And those two are completely related and correlated. I need people that think differently and can come and solve problems differently and innovate. And so our adversaries are innovating all the time. We need to be doing it too. And that's why cyber is definitely a space where we need to be inclusive about how we think about solving problems and how we bring people to the field. So how we advertise, how we write those position descriptions, how we demand that we have mixed slates, and our companies sort of enforce that and say, are we looking at a broad slate of candidates that represents the population? And I think that's really important to how we start to get more women interested and seeing themselves in these roles, in these leadership roles.
How do you think boards and companies could do a better job attracting more inclusive talent and even just retaining women in current cyber roles?
Yeah, the retention is a really interesting issue because this is a highly charged position. The chief information security officer and anyone leading cyber operations or other leadership positions in cyber, they're on the front lines. They're on the front lines of defending the company. If everything goes well, you don't hear a thing. It's quiet, right? You only hear when bad things happen.
Sure.
So these folks have a lot of professional risk, right? So companies, boards, other C-level executives need to understand this, be supportive, find out the things that are needed so that the CISO can enable the defense. The CISO is supported in what they're doing. And when that support is there and that sponsorship and that understanding, you have a very different relationship and a much stronger company in being resilient.
Lisa, if people want to learn a little bit more about this, where can they go? What do you recommend?
I recommend they come immediately to Accenture. Selfishly, we have a number of positions open, so it's Accenture.com/careers. And you'll learn about the careers that Accenture has, but there are 700,000 jobs open in the United States alone. So you can find these jobs in companies and private sector, public, everywhere. There are also apprentice programs. So if you're not sure or you have all the skills or your comfort isn't there, the apprentice programs are an amazing way to get your feet into the water, to test it out, and to get lots of learning along the way. And those are great programs. And Accenture also has an apprentice program.
And again, Accenture is spelled like it sounds like, Accenture. Lisa O'Connor, I really appreciate you coming on. And thank you for talking to us about this really important issue.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Absolutely. Lisa O'Connor again here on WICC. It's Fire Prevention Week. And I always know when it's Fire Prevention Week because my board op is a firefighter. But it's also, you know, working in the news. It's very important, though. The reason we have weeks like this is so that we can bring attention to, you know, how you could better protect yourselves, your family, make sure your house is ready. Because in the event of a fire, you want to know that you did everything you possibly could to make sure you got out of there okay. And, of course, you don't want that to happen. Nobody wants that to happen. So great timing to have a good friend of mine come back on. Bridgeport Fire Chief Mr. Lance Edwards is here right now. Good morning, Lance. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. How are you today?
I can't complain, friend. I'm so glad that you're with us. I actually, it was interesting because yesterday I had to go to an event. And I light a candle in the downstairs area where my dogs sleep because I just can't stand the smell of dog, even though I love dogs. And and as I'm leaving, I had to wait. It was so my husband's on his way home and I usually kind of get myself ready and whatever. And I had to whatever. And so he comes in the door. And as I'm leaving, as if he wouldn't notice, I pull back in really quickly, and he's like, aren't you going to be late for your event? I'm like, I just need to let you know there was a candle burning in the downstairs room, and I need you to blow it out when you're ready to go to bed. And he's like, okay. And I'm like, you know what? You think I'm crazy, but if that candle keeps burning, I'm going to have a heart attack, and I don't want to know that I destroyed my family. So, yeah, I do want to let you know that fire prevention is very serious in our household, and I know I hope it is for a lot of other people, though.
Same here. First of all, I want to thank you for having me, Melissa. And I do have to say two things. First of all, Mr. Larry Fullerton, what a great, great gentleman.
Amazing, right? Pastor Larry? Oh.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable human being. And second thing I have to say is I met two women the other day, Dorothy McGee and Daisy Lott, who are two longtime listeners to WICC. And these are two people who listen to the radio all day long.
Wow.
When they mention, you gotta be kidding me, all day? All day it's on WICC.
That's really impressive. And they should get an award, honestly. We have a couple people who listen from like sunup to sundown, and I'm like, wow, I can't even listen to myself like on an everyday basis. I've been stuck with my voice for 32 years, and that's amazing. You voluntarily listen for all day long. That's amazing.
Yes,
wow.
They do.
Thank you for sharing that. That actually made my day. That's great. It's awesome. So tell us, for Fire Prevention Week, what would you say are some of the biggest things that people maybe let go by the wayside or they don't really think about until it's too late?
Probably having a plan, an escape plan. So every year, this is actually the 100th anniversary for Fire Prevention Week. NFPA started this obviously 100 years ago, and every year there's a new theme. And this year's theme is Fire Won't Wait, Plan Your Escape. So I think that's one of the biggest mistakes homeowners and residents around the state of Connecticut, for some reason, they just don't understand the importance of that. They think just having a smoke alarm is good enough. But in reality, you really need to have a plan because, God forbid, if there is an actual fire, most people, they're anxious, they're nervous, and they think as if they're going to act normally, and you really don't. So the only way to act normally is to rely on your repetition and rely on the plan that you've discussed and worked with your family and friends.
Here's a question about, I have a couple questions about escape plans. What does a good escape plan look like? And again, I'm going to go back to my family. I don't know why we've been talking about fires a lot lately, but my husband and I, the other day, we were cleaning up our bathroom and we noticed, I don't know how, but we noticed that our bathroom window is actually maybe a 4-foot drop, if that, from our backyard. And my husband's like, oh my gosh, if there's a fire, hopefully not in our room, but if there's a fire, this has to be our way out. Like, this has to be, we got to get out this way because we're on a 2-story house. And so, and he's like, you know, if it's the downstairs, you know, go out the back, whatever. But he's like, this is another fire escape. This is great. I didn't even think of this. And so we're talking about it. And I thought to myself, yeah, but is this a good fire escape? What makes a good fire escape plan? Like, what should you be looking for?
Well, every plan is going to be different based on the layout of either the apartment or the home. So the fire department, the Bristol Fire Department, was invited to speak to residents of the P.T. Barnum housing complex probably about a month ago. So I'm not sure if your listeners remember, there was a deadly fire that took place probably back in 2009. And we recently had a fire there probably 3 years ago. And the fire there three years ago was started from fireworks. So they wanted to discuss exactly what you're concerned with. What is a great plan? And we tried to get the residents to understand each plan is going to be different based on the needs and the layout of your home and your apartment and what you're capable of doing. If you have younger residents, they probably would be able to climb out of a window and get down to safety without injury. But if you have elderly residents or elderly friends that live with you, that plan is going to be different. It may be, you know what, let's just figure out an area of safe refuge, shut the door, and make sure we call 911, open the window, and yell for help. And this way the fire department can get a ground ladder up to an upper story window in a quick manner to get the residents out. But every plan is going to be different based on the needs of the residents that live in that particular home.
It just dawned on me why we've been thinking about this a lot lately. So last week, Chief Edwards, I was at a seminar at my church. They were doing like a women's retreat thing at our church. And the speaker who was there was a best family friend to the family of Summer Fawcett. Do you remember Summer in May of this past year, the 7-year-old girl who died in the fire?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. I mean, there was not a dry eye in the audience. And I went home and I just sobbed to my husband because, you know, when you think about that family, a mother, a father, a son, and a daughter, and the only one who didn't make it out was the daughter, just a horrific story. And so it's been very fresh in my mind. And ironically enough, this week too, with Fire Prevention Week, really quick talking about kids. When is it appropriate to start sharing the escape plan with your kids? Like, what age should they know the plan?
The earlier, the better. And this plan should be worked at and practiced at least twice a year. So when you change your batteries, it's probably a good time for you to work on that escape plan to make sure that everyone is reinforced what the plan is. And we, a lot of times we have construction going on in the homes and you change the layout. If you change the layout of your house, you need to change your escape plan accordingly also. So just keep that in the back of your mind also. But the earlier, the better. So we're in schools. We go to kindergarten and pre-kindergarten. So we try to get them to understand the importance of fire safety at a very early age, and we're hoping that the parents are doing the same thing. There is no number, per se, say 5 or 8. The earlier, the better that they understand the importance of fire safety, the safer everyone's going to be.
How do you do it without scaring them?
Well, first of all, I hate to say it, when we go out to the schools, we bring a smoke alarm with us so they understand when they hear that beep going off, because we also understand it's very loud, and there's no reason to be afraid, because usually when you hear that, the next person you're going to see is your parent or an adult member that lives with you. But the one thing we don't want them to be is afraid of the decibels that come along with the smoke alarm. So the earlier you can introduce them into that loud pitch noise, the easier it's going to be for them to understand and grasp onto that escape plan that you develop with your partner.
So we're chatting this morning with Bridgeport Fire Chief Lance Edwards, and I wanted to talk about the biggest causes and the most common causes of fires, if you don't mind, Chief Edwards, especially as we go into the winter. You know, what do you find are some of the leading causes of house fires?
The number one cause is unattended food in the kitchen. People have a tendency to put food on the stove and decide, you know what, they want to catch up on their latest television program, and they forget, you know, because now the new word is binge, they start binge watching and forget that they left a pot of whatever food on the stove. That's the number one cause. So if you could just remember, if you're going to put a pot of anything on the stove and leave it unattended, have a lid somewhere near you, because a lid will actually stuff out the fire. Because people have a tendency, again, they get nervous and they get anxious when they walk in and they notice that maybe the flame has extended a little bit beyond their pot of food that was cooking. If they have a lid, very handy, all they have to do is put the lid on top of that pot and the fire will go out. At least contain it to that particular pot, opposed to extending to the cabinetry above. But the issue is to make sure that, A, you have a working smoke alarm, B, you keep a lid handy anytime you're cooking in the kitchen.
And I know you just said the smoke detectors, obviously, CO2 detectors, we talk about a lot, and making sure that people aren't being lazy. They're checking on them. They're changing the batteries. They're installing them if they're broken, things like that. But what do you think makes the difference between a controllable fire, one that I could handle if I have an oven fire, let's just say, versus out of control, total loss of the house, potential, you know, dangers to the people living in that house, firefighters, multiple departments on scene? What makes the difference between controllable and out of control fires?
Well, it's going to be based on education and knowledge. The one thing I do not want to do is encourage people to start tackling emergencies on their own. The first thing they want to do if they notice a fire or smoke or smell anything is to call 911. But if it's very early on, like contained to the pot, putting a lid on it will put the fire out, will extinguish it. Having a extinguisher handy, you could probably at least reduce a lot of damage to your kitchen. But if you walk into a room and it's open flame, if your curtains are burning, that's way beyond the scope of the average homeowner, and you need to call 911 and get everybody out of the house immediately.
What, you know, so as a kid, obviously, the biggest fire prevention thing we were always taught is the whole stop, drop, and roll thing. I mean, I think everybody knows stop, drop, and roll. But besides that, Chief, you know, there's something you said, Chief Edwards, that I think is so true. We panic. I think as humans, we panic unless we deal with something every day and we get into a emotion of knowing, okay, this is how it's going to be. Like, unless we prep ourselves, or if we were firefighters and we saw this often, I think most of us, if we're being honest, are going to panic. What are some other things we should know going into a situation, God forbid we're in that situation, of tackling a fire if we needed to, like you just said? So we had, this was years ago, my husband and I had our first condo, and we had an oven fire, and it was something burning in the oven. It wasn't like the oven was on fire. And so I, you know, my husband was downstairs showering. I panic. And I've never used at that time a fire extinguisher before. And so I totally misused it, had no idea. The thing is all over the place. I mean, we got the fire out. But, you know, my husband comes running upstairs in a towel because he's like, what in the world is going on? And he, you know, knew how to use one, which probably sounds really dumb. So listeners, please don't make fun of me. But you know, are there things that we should already be practicing ourselves and knowing ourselves in the case of even controllable fires in the kitchen or something like that?
Well, first of all, you want to learn how to utilize and use an extinguisher properly. So a lot of people go out and purchase an extinguisher in the event that there is a small fire that they think they could contain, but they forget the importance of training and understanding how to properly use it. And the time to figure out how to use it is not when you need to use it, because then it's too late. People don't even understand there's a lock on it. So they go to squeeze it and they can't figure out why it's not working. You have to understand that you have to be taught how to utilize and use an extinguisher on top of purchasing it. That's the second step. Purchasing is the first step. Second step is learning how to use it and when to use it safely. And understanding like the importance of carbon monoxide. We're lucky and fortunate enough, 4 years ago, we incorporated dual smoke alarms here in the city of Bridgeport. So we're not just picking up and detecting smoke, we're also detecting carbon monoxide. And especially this type of year, we're getting into the cold season. Most home heating units, whether it runs on gas or oil, produces carbon monoxide. And most people don't understand carbon monoxide, it's smoke poisoning that kills most people in fires. It's not open flame. Most people die from smoke inhalation. So what we try to do is get people to understand the importance of detecting carbon monoxide, because it's a silent killer. You go to sleep at night and you don't realize that your home heating unit is producing carbon monoxide, and you get up to certain levels, it can be deadly. And you just don't wake up, and we don't find out until a neighbor or a coworker decides to check on you.
Like a wellness check.
Exactly. By then, it's too late. So we're fortunate enough here to not just providing smoke alarms, but we provide dual smoke alarms that detect carbon monoxide as well.
Well, Chief Lance Edwards, I really appreciate you coming on this morning, talking about Fire Safety Week. Obviously, always welcome to come back on the show. Is there a place where people could get more information if they wanted to learn more?
Absolutely. First of all, you can follow us on social media, our Facebook page. We're always putting out safety tips, and our free smoke alarm program, which is for City of Bridgeport residents only, is 203-335-8835.
Okay. Well, Fire Chief Lance Edwards, always a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you so much for what you do and for taking the time to come on this morning.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
Oh, Chief Edwards, what would I do without him? Right here on WICC. As you know, it is October, which is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and all week long we have been talking to different doctors with Hartford HealthCare's St. Vincent's Medical Center. And this morning we are talking about breast reconstruction. So joining us now is plastic surgeon Dr. E. Sterling Craig. Good morning to you, Dr. Craig. So glad to have you here. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for being here. So first of all, tell us what it entails to get breast reconstruction and who gets that surgery done?
Sure, that's a great question. So breast cancer patients have the option to remove the breast cancer either through a surgery called a lumpectomy or a mastectomy. In both cases, either a portion of the breast or the entire breast is removed. So my job as a plastic surgeon is to try to fill those areas that were removed from needing the cancer removed. And that can be a combination of using implants, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with, or using their own fat and tissue from different parts of their body to kind of fill in that hole.
What happens after you get this surgery done? First of all, what are the chances that your cancer doesn't come back? Like, does this lessen your chances of getting cancer again, breast cancer at least again? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So there's been a lot of studies over the past 50 years that has shown that breast reconstruction does not impact the risk of recurrence. So that's why we're able to offer it to essentially almost any patient undergoing breast cancer treatment. The candidates for treatment are usually any patient that is going to have a mastectomy or a lumpectomy. And in terms of what they choose, a lot of it does depend on what their aesthetic goals are, as well as what their treatment is. So I work very closely with the oncologist and the radiation oncologist to make sure that the option that we choose does not impact their risk of recurrence or their long-term survival.
So I'm curious, Dr. Craig, we've been talking a lot about genetics this week because, unfortunately, a lot of the cases where we see patients diagnosed with breast cancer, it's a genetic thing. And it's something that they couldn't prevent. And we've talked a little bit about genetic testing. So I'm curious, if you're somebody who had a mother, a parent, a grandparent who had breast cancer, would you recommend people be, act ahead of time to be to go and get like a reconstruction surgery done before they could get cancer, like if they carry the gene?
Of course. I mean, I think the more that we can be proactive and preventative, the better it is, because then we're not treating cancer, we're preventing cancer. And the wonderful thing now about genetics is, maybe 20 years ago, we would have young patients with very advanced cancer. And because of genetics, now we can avoid those young patients from even getting the cancer by removing that organ, in this case, the breast, that would more or less be causing cancer in a patient that normally would be too young to even be screened. So we're being proactive and preventative, and essentially genetics is saving a lot of these young women's lives that otherwise wouldn't have known that they were going to get cancer.
So we're talking this morning to plastic surgeon Dr. E. Sterling Craig, who's with Hartford Healthcare's Cancer Center, or Institute, rather, at St. Vincent's Medical Center. And we're talking about breast reconstruction and getting the surgery done. What age, Dr. Craig, can you start debating getting reconstruction surgery? Like, what is the age range you typically have patients coming in to get the surgery?
For the genetic patients or the ones that have tested positive, for genetics, we start having those conversations, I would say, as soon as they feel comfortable engaging in that type of decision. So it is usually maybe later 20s, early 30s. We need to take into consideration if they want to have children and preservation of their fertility. But all of those conversations are at least good to start, because I think that's a very hard decision for somebody so young to make. So the more information from different providers they have, we try to make them feel comfortable with that process. And then obviously any patient that has felt a lump, we would want to see them as soon as they feel it. Please do not delay getting that worked up so that we can be proactive about treating the cancer and preventing it, hopefully, from coming back.
How do you help people who want to become mothers? So say you need to get the surgery done, whether it's that you have the genetics and it's saying, yep, you carry this gene, you are most likely going to be a candidate for breast cancer, or you are already dealing with like a low-level breast cancer. How does that impact future mothers, and how do you make the adjustment? Because obviously the big concern would be breast milk, being able to feed your children.
Right. So there are some types of surgery on the breast that do impact their ability to breastfeed. For example, if you're removing the entire breast in a mastectomy, that would obviously negate the ability to breastfeed. But in, for example, just a partial mastectomy or a lumpectomy where they take out just a portion of the breast, you are able to still breastfeed. But I think, nowadays we have different other ways, obviously, to nourish the baby as well. But I think from my standpoint, probably the more difficult aspect is there. Usually these women have a lot on their plate, and probably that stress is, is real and is even more difficult to manage. So we have an entire team that really helps facilitate them so they don't feel overwhelmed with that process.
And Dr. Craig, how common is it to get an infection, especially if you have implants? Like, do you have to get reconstruction surgery multiple times in your lifetime once you get it the first time?
That's a good question. I think there's a lot of sort of misinformation out there. So the risk of infection related to an implant is obviously higher than using our own tissue because it is foreign. And sometimes those rates are anywhere between 10 and 20%, depending on the literature that you read. Outside of the 30 days of surgery, that is, it drops considerably. However, it does depend on the other types of treatment that you are getting for your breast cancer. For example, if you're getting chemotherapy or radiation therapy, that risk of infection can then go back up because obviously your immune system is a little bit depressed during that time. But in general, once you've reached or completed those treatments, the risk of infection from an implant should be fairly low. When I say low, some less than 10%. That doesn't mean that that doesn't apply to everybody. But in general, if you have good contact with your plastic surgeon and are at least watching the breast, making sure that you don't have any redness, that it's not sore all of a sudden, then you really should be able to maintain that implant reconstruction for as long as the warranty on the implant allows.
Dr. Craig, I really appreciate you talking about reconstruction surgery. As you mentioned, I think there's a lot of misconceptions, but also I think it's a surgery that unless you've gotten it done yourself, many people have questions about. And again, Dr. Craig is a plastic surgeon with Hartford HealthCare's Cancer Institute at St. V's. If you would like to learn more, you can go to hartfordhealthcare.org/cancer. Thank you, Dr. Craig.
Thank you. My pleasure. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. So I got a very sweet video sent to me by a group of girls who go to a local high school here in our listening area. And they were touting the fact that their coach puts mental health needs of his athletes first before many other coaches who will put, you know, the skills of the game and their performance and their winning streak and all of that. Which, look, that's important. You know, you want to have the best team possible and you want your kids to thrive and to do well. But at what expense are we willing to do that? And so they sent me this video, and I'm talking about Stratford High School's softball team. They sent me this video, and it featured somebody who I admire very much, and I got to know over the past couple of months after meeting him in studio. His name is Gary Sherrick, and he is the head coach for the high school softball team over at Stratford High. And I wanted Gary to come on this morning because I know it's not technically World Mental Health Day today. It was earlier this week. But I wanted to talk about this because I think it's a topic that's important every day. Also, October is Depression Awareness Month. And when you look at national statistics, when it comes to emotional disorders, for example, about 4% of kids 10 to 14 years old and about 5% of 15 to 19 year olds are experiencing anxiety disorders as we speak right now. And that's just one of the many issues that we see teens and preteens dealing with in everyday life today. And so I wanted to bring Gary on, talk about why he, you know, does things a little bit differently than the average coach would. And I'm sure it makes him very uncomfortable that I'm blowing up his spot, but I don't care. Gary Sherrick, welcome back to the show. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, Gary, first of all, you're taking on a lot of teenage girls. Let's just talk about that. It's a lot. I was a teenage girl once myself, and it's a lot. It's a lot to take on.
Yeah, it's a good practice because I have two daughters. So
there you go. So you'll be great. You'll be like a power dad. You'll be the best dad.
I think that's the only reason why I'm coaching is just to learn how to deal with my two daughters when they get to become teenagers. But it's definitely been a task.
I would think so. And when you bring up mental health, is this something that has always been important to you, or is it something just in recent years as you hear about newscasts and the focus on mental health so much, or has this always been something important to you?
So it's always been important because, like, when I was growing up, mental health was always there, but it never was talked about. Between myself, some friends, some family that have gone through stuff, it's always been there. But then it's almost like avocados. Like, I feel like avocados have always been there, but until, like, 10 years ago, everyone's been putting avocados on everything.
Oh, you're so right. I love that analogy. Yes, you're right. I was like, where is he going with this one? That's so funny. Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, like avocado toast is the thing to do, apparently. It's literally just avocado on toast. Yeah, that's so funny.
Exactly. But guacamole's been around forever. So, I mean, it's always been there. So between that and then once we started coaching, my wife and I started coaching high school females, it turned into, you know, okay, like I have to develop patience and develop a little more lingo and open-minded with things. And kids just started coming to me with issues that were not sports related.
Like what?
And just like anything between, you know, love life issues, schoolwork, this, and then like, then it turned into, I don't feel important. I don't feel wanted. I don't feel like I belong. And then I was like, wait a second, this is a lot bigger than your standard school stuff.
And yeah, that's deep.
This is before COVID. This is before COVID. And now you talk about the pandemic. And if you think about it, all of our students, not just student athletes, but students that are in schools are actually a year behind. developing
sure, absolutely.
In every aspect. I'm not saying teachers and parents didn't do everything they could possibly for when everyone was remote, but if you think about it, especially sports-wise, these kids are a year behind.
Oh, absolutely.
So my seniors are actually junior-wise athletically and vice versa down the, you know, down the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
So when they come up to me with issues, it's not just like I'm struggling hitting, I'm doing this. It's I'm struggling with everything.
Mm.
And that's when I was like, I can't – how am I going to be successful on the field if we can't be successful in life or in the classrooms or even at home?
I mean, what was that like for you, Gary? I mean, I'm sure when you signed up to be a softball coach, you signed up to be a softball coach. And then, you know, to take on, you know, becoming, wow, wait a minute, hold on, we need to be bigger than just sports. I mean, that's really not common. I don't hear about a lot of coaches that will step to the side and say, hey, you know what, a loss is a loss, we'll deal with it, but this is somebody's life. And that's a big task.
Now, don't get me wrong. I do not like losing. but
good, fair,
I do understand. I do understand that, you know, every school is different, whether it's public schools or private schools. Every school is different with their academics or sports. There's always the end goal, like, let's get these kids graduated to do better things, whether it's military, jobs, school, after high school. Let's get them there. But I just feel like when it comes to sports, especially in our school, but it's not just our school. I've talked to other coaches all over the state, all different sports, and they're dealing with the same stuff. And they're like, how do you do it? And I'm like, patience. Just listen. Like, I had 30 girls come out for the softball team last year. And out of those 30 girls, maybe 5 or 6 that weren't returners had any experience at all with softball.
Mm.
And by the end of the year, you would think that they all played their whole lives and played together because – The bond was there. Not so much the athletic ability, but it was getting there. And it was just one of those things that was so grateful. Like at the end of the year, we did some fundraising. We bought every single kid a zip up, a quarter zip fleece, put their name on it, put Stratford Softball on it. And you would have thought someone just handed them the keys to a new car.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah, but you're right.
It's those little things. And I've talked to other schools that are like dominant programs, great programs, some of the best in the state. And they're like, how do we get to that? And I'm like, it all starts at home as well.
Mm.
Not just athletics, school, in my opinion, too. Everything starts at home.
Yeah, you had mentioned, I think, in your video, Gary, which I thought was so interesting, because I can remember from my brother's baseball days, the parents who would be like, why didn't you get up to the plate and hit the ball today? And I would always laugh because I'd be like, you act like they can control that. I mean, you know, and I've seen it. Like I said, I've watched my brother do competitive ball. He went to Division I college for ball. So I've seen it. And like those questions are just so crazy. And I understand it. Like, yes, we all want to win. We all want to be the best. But like, at what expense of your child? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, too, is like, don't get me wrong. I believe in high standards. I believe in setting goals.
Oh, totally.
And I'm not saying every single person should lower their standards, but I think we should make them smaller. And then once you accomplish that, do another one. And then obviously, like, the whole philosophy is, you know, like, small things add up to the big things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very thankful that I haven't heard any of my parents say that stuff necessarily, but other teams. And I'm like, do I get involved? Do I not? And I'm like, you know what? Not my place. You know, because
right.
Next thing you know, I got a girl from another team bawling her eyes out. And I'm like, the dad mode's starting to kick in. And I'm like, what do I do? And,
yeah, that's hard.
You know, it's just, I truly believe that when it comes to sports and not just sports, but even academics. I have this conversation with my players all the time. They go, I have to take an AP class. And I'm like, why? And they're like, because I have to. It looks good. And I'm like, but it doesn't look good if you struggle in that class.
Right.
And I'm like, don't give me that, like, oh, at least I tried. No, listen, start at maybe an honors class. Do well there. And if that wasn't challenging enough,
then go to AP. Right. Right.
You know, and that's like even some of like these kids that are like, oh, I've got to go play Division I sports.
Why?
You don't.
Right.
You don't.
Right.
You don't. If you want to play at the next level, that's your dream. That's your dream. Go ahead. Find somewhere to play.
Mm-hmm.
You can get your education and you can enjoy the environment and you can play ball or whatever sport you're going to play.
Yeah. Well, you know, Gary, I think you make so much sense. And whether people think it's a news story or not, I think it's so important that we highlight people like you. I really do. I think that's what this show is about. I think it's important to highlight people who are breaking barriers and are doing things to actually make a difference. Listen, we could pass as many laws as we want, and we can open as many, you know, healthcare places that focus on mental health as we want, and that's great. But if we're not doing it on just our own terms at home, like you said, in school, on the field, in our everyday lives, we're just not going to see big improvements. We're really not. So I just want to thank you. Unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I want to thank you for what you do. And thanks for coming on the air. I know you were like, no, come on. It's fine. I know you didn't want to, but I appreciate it. I really do.
No, I appreciate everything you do and all the topics you bring up. And it's just, you know, the biggest thing is we just got to keep moving forward and do what we got to do, because just like you, we have kids, we want to make the place better, and we'll do whatever we got to do it.
Yeah, absolutely, including straightening hair, which is what he did yesterday for his girls
during
picture day.
I was
very impressed with you, Mr. Gary. That was
very cool. My wife is the culprit. She does very well, and I had to make sure it wasn't messed up when we left. So.
Well, I thought you did a great job. Your girls look great. Gary, thank you so much for coming on, and thanks for what you do. Really appreciate
that. Thanks, Melissa.
Gary Sherrick, again, the Stratford High School softball coach right here on WICC.